Chapter 6. The Power of Getting Started. Just get started. I don't have to look very far for a story about this topic. My own life supplies many examples daily. When I face a task that I find aversive, a task I simply don't want to do, a task that I find boring or tedious, or even a task for which I have doubts about my competence, it is tempting to walk away. I want to procrastinate. I find myself saying things like this to myself: I'll feel more like doing this later. This is a flag for me. It is a signal that I have learned to identify that I'm just about to procrastinate. At that very moment, I use this signal to just get started. I will immediately start on anything related to the task at hand. Let's explore why this is so important. Issue. Once we start a task, it's rarely as bad as we think. Our research shows us that getting started changes our perception of a task. It can also change our perception of ourselves in important ways. In a series of studies, my students and I used electronic pagers to gather what is called experience sampling data. We paged research participants randomly throughout the day over a week or two. Each time we paged them, we asked them things like, "What are you doing? Is there something else you should be doing? How are you feeling? What are you thinking?" In addition, depending on the study, we asked the participants to rate what they were doing and what they were supposed to be doing on things like how stressful they perceived the task to be. A rating of 10 indicated extremely stressful, while a 0 meant not stressful at all, and all points in between reflected the variability. This type of data allowed us to take a sort of snapshot through time of what the participants were doing. Importantly, we also got a real-time glimpse of what they were thinking and feeling. Some of our findings were expected. Some surprised us. I have summarized these findings by simplifying the research as a Monday to Friday process and by focusing mainly on the task avoidance. As expected, on Monday, when participants were avoiding some tasks, for example, working on an assignment, in preference to other activities, for example, hanging out with friends, we found they typically said things like, "I'll feel more like that tomorrow," or, "Not today, I work better under pressure." As you learned in the previous chapter, we rationalized the dissonance between our behaviors, not doing, and our expectations of ourselves, "I should be doing this now." Of course, later in the week, none of the participants spontaneously said things like, "I feel like doing that avoided task today," or, "I'm glad I waited until tonight because I work better like this." Surprisingly, we found a change in the participants' perceptions of their tasks. On Monday, the dreaded avoided task was perceived as very stressful, difficult, and unpleasant. On Thursday, or the wee hours of Friday morning, once they had actually engaged in the task they had avoided all week, their perceptions changed. The ratings of task stressfulness, difficulty, and unpleasantness decreased significantly. What did we learn? Once we start a task, it's rarely as bad as we think. In fact, many participants made comments when we paged them during their last-minute efforts that they wished they had started earlier. The task was actually interesting, and they thought they could do a better job with a little more time. Just get started. That is the moral here. Once we start, our attributions of the task change. Based on other research, we know that our attributions about ourselves change too. First, once we get started, as summarized above, we perceive the task as much less aversive than we do when we are avoiding it. Second, if we do not finish the task, we have done something, and the next day, our attributions about ourselves are not nearly as negative. We feel more in control and more optimistic. You might even say we have a little momentum. Research by Ken Sheldon, University of Missouri, Columbia, also demonstrates that progress on our goals makes an important difference. Progress on our goals makes us feel happier and more satisfied with life. Interestingly, positive emotions have the potential to motivate goal-directed behaviors and volitional processes, for example, self-regulation to stay on task, that are necessary for further goal progress or attainment. Very clearly, we can see how if we prime the pump by making some progress on our goals, the resulting increase in our subjective well-being enhances further action and progress. Of course, this simple advice is not the whole solution to the procrastination puzzle, but it is a crucial first step towards solving it and decreasing our procrastination. In the next chapter, I take us past this initial step. Strategy for change. When you find yourself thinking things like, "I'll feel more like doing this tomorrow. I work better under pressure. There's lots of time left. I can do this in a few hours tonight." Let that be a flag or signal or stimulus to indicate that you are about to needlessly delay the task, and let it also be the stimulus to just get started. This is another instance of the if-then type of implementation intention. I've raised the notion of an implementation intention a few times already, but I've not provided details about what it is. As defined in the Well-Developed Psychology of Action created by Peter Gollwitzer, University of New York, an implementation intention supports a goal intention by setting out in advance when, where, and how we will achieve this goal, or at least a sub-goal within the larger goal or task. It is not as effective to make ourselves a to-do list of goal intentions as it is to decide how, when, and where we're going to accomplish each of the tasks we need to get done. There's an accumulating body of research by Peter Gollwitzer and his colleagues that demonstrates the efficacy of implementation intentions for initiating behaviors, including following through on the intentions to take vitamins, participating in regular physical activity after surgery, and acting on environmentally minded intentions, such as purchasing organically grown foods. In short, implementation intentions are a powerful tool to move from a goal intention to an action. As I have outlined in earlier chapters, these implementation intentions take the form of if-then statements. The if part of the statement sets out some stimulus for action. The then portion describes the action itself. The issue here really is one of pre-decision. We are trying to delegate the control over the initiation of our behavior to a specified situation without requiring conscious decision. If I say to myself things like, "I'll feel more like doing this later," or "I don't feel like doing this now," then I will just get started on some aspect of the work. Notice that we are not using the famous Nike slogan of "just do it." It's about just getting started. The doing it will take care of itself once we get going. If we think about just doing it, we risk getting overwhelmed with all there is to do. If we just take a first step, that is much easier. As a strategy, you may find that you have to just get started many times throughout the day, even on the same task. This is common. Even in meditation, we have to gently bring our attention back to our focal point, whatever that may be, for example, our breath, a mantra. The thing to remember is that just getting started may happen many times in a day. All of our procrastination gets stopped short when we just get started. It's not the whole solution by any means, but it is a huge and crucial first step. As is commonly said, a job begun is a job half done. It is tempting to run away from this strategy, to criticize it because it's exactly your problem. You're not able to get started. Not so. You think you're not able to get started, probably because you're focused on your feelings, which are negative, and you're thinking about the whole task, about getting it done, as opposed to getting started. The trick is to find something that you can get started on. Keep it really simple. Keep it as concrete as possible, too. Research by Sean McRae, University of Konstanz, and his colleagues has shown that thinking abstractly about our goals leads us to believe that they are not that urgent or pressing. More concrete thoughts about your goal or task, more concrete plans, lead to more timely action. In other words, more concrete plans will help you just get started. An implementation intention helps you get started. It is your pre-decision, so that you do not get caught up in thinking, choosing, deciding. You've already made the decision. Now is the time to act. Here is a common example from an academic context. When facing a writing task, perhaps a term paper, it is possible to just sit and stare at a blank computer screen. As you do, anxiety builds, and pretty soon you're giving in to feel good. You're away from your desk another day, and guilt is building fast. So, instead of staring at the blank screen, start typing. Start with a title page. Put your name on it. Add the title if you know it, at least something as a working title. Begin your reference page if you are still not ready to write. Begin jotting down ideas about what you would write about if you could write. You do not have to write sentences, but you can if they come. The thing is, you are now actually working on the task. It is rough, but everything begins that way, rough. Carpenters rough frame houses. Sculptors carve and shape rough surfaces into smooth ones. Farmers disc and harrow rough plowed fields into fields ready for planting. We are always starting somewhere to work toward the finished product. The other way to think about this is the old saying that a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Take that first step. Just get started. It can make all the difference. Honestly, if you're not ready to make this first step to just get started on a day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis, then you should stop listening now. You're not committed to change yet, and nothing else I have to say will matter in your self-change. Don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to discourage you, I'm just being honest. I will tell you more about other strategies, the role of willpower, and even the effects of our personalities on procrastination in upcoming chapters, but you must know that it will always come down to that precipitous moment when you just get started. It will always come down to that movement from not doing to doing. For tasks that we would rather avoid, this is a difficult but wonderful moment. So we are back to where I began the chapter, with the mantra, just get started. To this, I have added a couple of other phrases that you might want to use as your own personal mantra. These are, prime the pump, a job begun is a job half done, and a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. In closing this chapter, I'd like you to pick a task or a goal that you're procrastinating on and that is really bothering you. Write down as many of the subtasks that you think of that are required to get this task done. Now, looking at that list, indicate which of these is a priority or which subtask makes most sense for you to complete first. This is the place to just get started. However, even with this list of tasks, you may not know how to proceed. This is simply a reality, and it may not be possible to be completely rational in your approach, but you can still get started. Pick a task, any task, and let that suffice. You may even have to flail around a bit, but if you get started, at least you'll find your way. Not starting will guarantee that you will remain stuck. You can take this approach for just about any goal or task that you have. In fact, when you just cannot seem to get started on a task, get started by breaking down the task into subtasks, but don't stop there, as tempting as it may be some days. It is true for many of us that after we make a list like this, we feel better and we think we've accomplished something, so we actually stop. Another excuse for procrastination. Don't forget, the purpose of that list is to get you started. Just get started. Chapter 7. Why getting started isn't the whole solution. I need to be prepared to deal with distractions, obstacles, and setbacks. Hans has really been taking his stop procrastinating goal to heart. Today, rather than put off work on his report as he typically has, he just got started. He was surprised at how good he felt. He even felt optimistic about the results. Then, about 45 minutes into his work, the phone rang. Bruce, a friend Hans sees daily, was calling him with an invitation to play squash. Bruce's expected partner had canceled at the last minute, so Bruce was hoping Hans would fill in even though they had played the day before. Although Hans intended to work through the afternoon, to make up for time he'd already lost, he felt like things were under control now, so he told Bruce he would meet him at 12:30 at the gym. Issue. In the scenario above, Hans's goal was his report, and he made the key first step of getting started. In fact, the night before, Hans had made an implementation intention to begin his work right after he finished breakfast, and he did. He made his pre-decision with, "If breakfast is done, then I will immediately go to my desk and start working on the third section of my report." Note that he had a concrete task for his action with the third section of the report, a section that he felt would be an easy place to begin, even though it was not the beginning of the report itself. He felt very good about finally doing this. At the very least, there is usually a sense of relief when we get to an avoided task. Unfortunately, these good feelings can be a little bit of a trap for us. They can make us feel overly optimistic, and some of our biases in planning and thinking may begin to emerge. In fact, Hans felt his mind begin to wander, and typical thoughts emerged when he was even a little bit stuck in his progress. At one point, when he hit a tough spot in the writing, he caught himself thinking, that's enough for today. I'll feel more like doing this part tomorrow. In fact, he was somewhat relieved when Bruce called. It seemed a perfect excuse to stop. Certainly exercise is important in life too, he thought. What this means in terms of more successful goal pursuit is that we have to recognize other points at which we typically abandon our goal pursuit. We have to be prepared to address each of these as they arise. Otherwise, we'll fall back into habitual ways of responding. If you tend to procrastinate more often than you like, then your habitual response will be to find some way to avoid the task at hand. Procrastination is not just a failure to get started. We can face a variety of problems and needlessly delay at many stages of goal pursuit. Our feelings may still threaten to derail us. Distractions abound, and it's easy to replace one intention with another, even if just for a minute. And in all of this, we can find ways to justify this to ourselves. In the scenario above, the squash invitation can be seen as an unnecessary disruption, given how regularly Hans sees his friend, as well as Hans's intention to work today. Perhaps a more common example for those of us working at our computers is becoming distracted and putting off the task at hand by checking email or surfing the web. I know from my research that internet technologies in particular are potent distractors, as it will only take a minute to check my email, and then hours later you find you're still off task. I discuss this in more detail in Chapter 10. What this means is that we cannot simply depend on our goal intentions, no matter how deeply committed we might be, to keep our volitional actions on track. We have to be prepared to deal with changes in our mood related to setbacks and disappointments. We have to be prepared to deal with distractions. We have to be prepared to overcome obstacles. Given the ongoing challenges to our goal pursuit, we would benefit from implementation intentions related to the potential distractions and obstacles ahead. We can make pre-decisions to help us here, too. Strategies for change. There are two main approaches to pre-decisions regarding potential distractions. The first involves reducing the number of distractions before we begin to work. The second approach takes us back to implementation intentions to help us decide ahead of time what we will do when distractions, obstacles, or setbacks arise. I outline each of these below. Minimizing distractions. Different things distract each of us. Some people cannot work with a radio on in the background or in a noisy room. Others, more extroverted personalities, need that background noise. This means that we have to think about what our typical distractions are. In a world dominated by computer-related tasks and jobs, certainly some of these distractions are other activities on the computer, such as games, social networking tools, web searches, or even just email. I discuss these potent distractions under internet procrastination in the final chapter. For now, I would just add them to our list of potential distractions or obstacles. The key to this strategy of minimizing distractions is to be proactive. Before you begin to work, make sure that you have removed these potential distractions. This might include shutting your door, shutting off the ringer on your phone, shutting off your cell phone. Text messaging is a chronic distraction for many people. Shutting down social networking tools, Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, whatever you use, and removing potentially distracting things from your workspace, for example, magazines or newspapers. If you listen to that paragraph again, you will note that shutting is a key verb. You are shutting yourself away from distractions to help maintain your attention and focus on your intended task. This is your pre-decision to help you work. Of course, you cannot anticipate every distraction, obstacle, or setback in your work. For example, Hans did not expect Bruce to call with the invitation to play squash. You will need another strategy to deal with distractions as they arise. That is the purpose of implementation intentions. Implementation intentions. Implementation intentions can work to shield our intentions from competing possibilities, as they can take the form of if-then statements that anticipate distractions. In fact, experimental research by Peter Gollwitzer and his colleagues has shown that participants who form temptation-inhibiting implementation intentions outperform the groups who did not. Importantly, this effect was independent of the participants' motivation to achieve the goal and to ignore distractions. Implementation intentions have effects over and above our motivation to succeed. This is important. Commitment and motivation alone will not always get us through. It is time to think about your main procrastinated tasks again. As a closing activity to this chapter, list the kinds of distractions and obstacles that have resulted in further procrastination, even when you have actually been working on the task. For each of these, note whether you can remove it prior to task engagement and/or add an implementation intention as your pre-decision about how you will act when it arises in the future. For example, a potential distraction may be email, and my decision might be, yes, I can shut this off before I work, so I can deal with that proactively. Another example might be the example we had in the chapter of a friend's invitation, and here, an implementation intention may be more effective. For example, if my friends call to invite me out this weekend, then I will immediately say, thanks, but no, I'm committed to finishing my work. A final example might be the common feeling of, I'm stuck on my work and I don't know what to do. Here, an implementation intention might be effective again. If I get stuck, confused, and worried because I don't know what to do, then I will stay put and list what I do know to be sure what it is I don't know. Once I know this, I can seek help if needed. I won't give up. Continue with your own examples, deciding whether you would be proactive or if you would form an implementation intention to deal with potential distraction, obstacles, or setbacks. When you're finished, continue to the next chapter. Chapter 8. Willpower, willpower. If we only had the willpower. Willpower is a limited resource that I need to use strategically. Rachel's exercise goal wasn't becoming a reality. Given her very early start each day to get the kids off to school and out to work herself, she put aside time after dinner to get on the treadmill. However, after an exhausting day in her law firm, along with the day-to-day challenges of orchestrating school, daycare schedules, and the many household chores she shares with her husband, she couldn't seem to muster the get up and go to get up and go. She was frustrated. She didn't seem to have the willpower to get off the couch. Every night she put it off again, hoping tomorrow would be different. Issue. Willpower is a limited resource. I think many of us know this from experience. Roy Baumeister, Florida State University, as well as his students and colleagues, have demonstrated this in a series of clever experiments. It is worth reviewing these to make the point. In the typical experiment, research participants are randomly assigned to one of two groups. Both groups expect that they will participate in two tasks, but there is an important difference between the groups in terms of the self-regulation demanded of them in the first task. In the first task, the participants in the experimental group are required to self-regulate a great deal, whereas the participants in the control group are simply asked to do the task. For example, participants in both groups may be asked to watch a funny film, but the participants in the experimental group would be required to self-regulate by suppressing their emotional expression, while the participants assigned to the control group would be given no specific instructions about how to react. In a similar study, participants in both groups arrive hungry, but the experimental group is invited to eat radishes while resisting a tempting plate of cookies, whereas the control group is allowed to eat the cookies or the radishes. You guess which is more popular. In each of these experiments, the participants in the experimental group exercise self-regulation, while the participants in the control group do not. Once this first task is completed, both groups are asked to complete a second task that involves self-regulation. Participants in both groups need to self-regulate their behavior to achieve success, and the key outcome measure is how persistent participants in each group are. For example, typical second tasks include things like complex figure tracing, solving complex anagrams, drinking an unpleasant but not harmful sports drink, and my favorite, resisting drinking free beer. A driving test is expected to follow. The main idea is that this second task requires self-regulation, and the hypothesis is that the participants in the experimental group will perform more poorly, not persist as long, because they have already exhausted their ability to self-regulate. The findings of these studies consistently demonstrate that the participants in the experimental group perform at a lower level than the control group. Given the differences in the self-regulatory demands of the first task, the researchers conclude that the participants in the experimental group have exhausted their self-regulatory strength, at least temporarily, and therefore are unable to muster the self-regulation required for the second task. In a practical real-life example of this, one study showed that, after coping with a stressful day at work, people were less likely to exercise and more likely to do something more passive, like watching television. This takes us back to where we began with Rachel. No wonder she can't muster the get up and go to exercise. She has exhausted her willpower. Strengthening our willpower, the role of motivation. The self-regulatory impairments I just discussed are eliminated or reduced when participants are highly motivated to self-regulate on the second task. For example, when participants are paid for doing well in the second task, or they are convinced that the performance will have social benefits, they perform well despite the apparent self-regulatory exhaustion from the first task. The key thing about these findings is that they indicate that self-regulatory depletion may be reducing motivation. Given that depleted self-regulatory strength may leave us feeling like we won't succeed, we're too tired to try, it may be that the reduced expectancy of success undermines our willingness to exert effort. It's not that we're so impaired that we cannot respond, it's that we don't feel like it. Sound familiar? I'll feel more like it tomorrow. This is a common phrase we use to rationalize our procrastination. Perhaps it simply captures our perceptions of self-regulatory strength at the moment. Of course, it is a perception and, I argue, at least partly, an illusion. It's about our motivation to muster the self-regulatory effort. Unwilling, perhaps, not unable. From this perspective, what we see is that we may fail to self-regulate because we acquiesce. In the case of procrastination, we find resisting the urge to do something else, an alternative intention, impossible to resist. So we give up and give in. Strategies for change. We all feel depleted throughout the day. We all have moments where we think, I'm exhausted, I just can't do anymore, or I'll feel more like this tomorrow. This is true. This is how we are feeling at the moment. However, successful goal pursuit often depends on our moving past these momentary feelings of depletion. Given the role of motivation in self-regulatory failure, it is crucial to acknowledge the role of higher-order thought in this process, particularly the ability to transcend the feelings at the moment in order to focus on our overall goals and values. In the absence of cues to signal the need for self-regulation, we may give in to feel good and stop trying. It is exactly when we say to ourselves, "I'll feel more like it tomorrow," that we have to stop, take a breath, and think about why we intended to do the task today. Why is it important to us? What benefit is there in making the effort now? How will this help us achieve our goal? From there, if we can muster the volitional strength for one more step, that is to just get started, we will find that we had more self-regulatory strength in reserve than we realized. Our perception can fool us at times, and this self-deception can really be our own worst enemy. Here are some strategies that you might use to muster what feels like the fumes left in your own willpower gas tank. 1. The willpower is like a muscle metaphor is a good fit, as the capacity for self-regulation can be increased with regular exercise. Even 2 weeks of self-regulatory exercise has improved research participants' self-regulatory stamina. So take on some small self-regulatory task and stick to it. This can be as simple as deliberately maintaining good posture or using your non-dominant hand to eat. The key element is to exercise your self-discipline. You don't need to start big. Just be consistent and mindful on your focus. Over time, you will be strengthening your willpower muscle. 2. Sleep and rest also help to restore the ability to self-regulate. If you seem to be at the end of your rope, unable to cope, and unwilling to do the next task, first ask yourself if you're getting enough sleep. 7 or 8 hours of sleep is important for most of us to function well. 3. A corollary to sleep and rest is that self-regulation later in the day is less effective. Be as strategic as possible, and don't look to exercise feats of willpower later in the day. Rachel may have to rethink the timing of her workout or use alternative strategies that I'll explain in a moment to help her get off the couch when she's already running on empty. 4. A positive boost of emotion has been shown to eliminate self-regulatory impairment. Find things, people, or events that make you feel good to replenish your willpower strength. 5. Implementation intentions can be added to this list of willpower boosters. Make an implementation intentions as a plan for action. As you know, this takes a specific form. In situation X, I will do behavior Y to achieve my goal Z. Or, if this happens, then I'll do this, anticipating obstacles to your goal pursuit. The effect of these intentions is to put the stimulus for action into the environment and make the control of behavior a non-conscious process. A couple of studies have demonstrated that the automatic nature of the effects of implementation intentions counters the effects of self-regulatory depletion. Let's take the example where research participants had to control their emotions during a humorous movie, suppressing their laughter. As you will recall, they are usually less capable of doing a subsequent experimental task that requires self-regulatory strength, such as solving a series of anagrams. However, for the participants randomly assigned to an if-then implementation intention manipulation, who prepared by saying to themselves, "If I solve an anagram, then I will immediately start to work on the next one," this depletion effect was eliminated. They solved as many anagrams as the group who were not depleted beforehand. This is an interesting result with clear implications for how we can strengthen our flagging willpower at the end of a long day. An implementation intention may well be the thing that gets you to exercise in the evening, even though you usually feel much too tired to begin. Note, this research underscores my focus on just getting started. I think Rachel might be more successful with her evening exercise if she had the implementation of, If the kids are in bed, then I will go directly to the treadmill. Once she starts, she might discover that she has the motivation and energy that she needs. 6. Self-regulation appears to depend on available blood glucose. In some studies, even a single act of self-regulation has been shown to reduce the amount of available glucose in the bloodstream, impairing later self-regulatory attempts. Interestingly, just a drink of sugar-sweetened lemonade eliminated this self-regulatory depletion in experiments. Even though this research hasn't always been replicated, the message is clear. Don't get hypoglycemic. Your self-regulation will suffer. Keep a piece of fruit, complex carbohydrate, handy to restore blood glucose. 7. Be aware that social situations can require more self-regulation and effort than you may think. For example, if you are typically an introverted person, but you have to act extroverted, or you have to suppress your desired reaction, scream at your boss, in favor of what is deemed more socially acceptable, acquiesce again to unreasonable demands, you will deplete your willpower for subsequent action. These social interactions may even make it more likely that you will say or do something you will regret in subsequent interactions. Getting along with others requires self-regulation, so you will need to think about points 1 to 6 to be best prepared to deal with demanding social situations. 8. Finally, so much of our ability to self-regulate depends on our motivation. Even on an empty stomach, exhausted from not enough sleep, and pushed to the limit for self-regulation, we can muster the willpower to continue to act appropriately. It is difficult, but it can be done, particularly if we focus on our values and goals to keep perspective on more than just the present moment. In doing this, we can transcend the immediate and temporary feelings we are having to keep from giving in to feel good, which lies at the heart of so much self-regulatory failure. Chapter 9. What's Bred in the Bone? Personality and Procrastination. My personality might put me at risk, but I can adapt. Fiona and David have been married for more than 10 years now. Fiona's friends describe her as organized. Typically, she's the planner in their group, and they know that they can really count on her. When there's something to be done, she does it right away. David sets high standards for himself. He's also very self-critical. He seems to hear his parents' voice echo in his mind whenever he approaches a task, saying, "It could be better." When faced with a task, David always seems reluctant to get started. Fiona and David are very similar when it comes to household tidiness. They are both quite particular, even fussy, but they can drive each other crazy at times when it comes to scheduling and doing tasks. Issue. The example above highlights the notion of individual differences. We might think of Fiona as conscientious and David as a perfectionist. This approach to personality is based on the concept of personality traits. Traits are terms that psychologists use to summarize the way we typically act. Traits describe something about how we expect a person to act in most situations. Of course, how we actually behave depends on both personality and situation. But for the moment, I want to focus on personality traits. Certainly, procrastination has been shown to be related to personality traits. Some people are more prone to procrastinate, and a contributing factor is personality. This is particularly true when the situational pressures to engage in a task in a timely manner are not strong. When the situation is not pushing us to act in a certain way, for example, a supervisor actually monitoring our actions, our personality will have a great deal of influence on our behavior. The examples above provide two very common traits related to procrastination, but in different directions. Fiona's conscientiousness, that is, the fact that she is typically organized, planful, and dutiful, is a trait that is highly negatively related to procrastination. The more we are conscientious, the less we typically procrastinate. In contrast, David is an example of a socially prescribed perfectionist. Yes, there are different varieties or types of perfectionism. The one we need to focus on is the socially prescribed perfectionist because it is most strongly related to procrastination. Socially prescribed perfectionists believe that others hold unrealistic expectations for their behavior and that they cannot live up to these expectations. They experience external pressure to be perfect and believe that others evaluate them critically. This leads them to internalize these expectations and be self-critical as well. That little voice in David's head is an example of this internalized criticism. Contrasting Fiona and David like this shows how personality can be a resilience or risk factor for procrastination. We need to take this into account in our own lives. Would you say that you have a procrastination-prone personality? To answer this question, you need to have a little more information about which personality traits have been shown to be associated with procrastination. I'm going to list some key traits that are related to procrastination. I just need to make one more comment before I read you this list. There are potentially thousands of personality traits. Personality psychologists have simplified these into a superstructure of traits known as the Big Five. Much like the three colors of the color wheel, the Big Five are said to be the primary traits. Other traits are a part of these five or a blend of them. You can remember the five traits with the mnemonic canoe. C is for conscientiousness, A is for agreeableness, N is for neuroticism, O is for openness to experience, and E is for extroversion, canoe. Of course, in a short audio program, I cannot explain each of these in detail, and it is really not that important because our focus is on procrastination. Research pioneered by Henri Schoenberg, University of Groningen, and Clary Lay, York University, has revealed that only two of these traits have meaningful relations with procrastination, conscientiousness and neuroticism, which is also known as emotional instability. The other traits that I need to discuss are related to the Big Five traits, but I address them separately because they deserve special consideration given their relation to procrastination. For example, impulsiveness is sometimes discussed as a part of low emotional stability, sometimes extroversion. In any case, it is not necessary to focus on these definitional issues. Just think of these traits as aspects of our personalities. Instructions. For each of the traits I present, rate yourself from not at all like me to exactly like me on how much you think the trait describes you. 1. Conscientiousness. Highly conscientious people are described as responsible, scrupulous, persevering, and fussy or tidy. You can see how this trait is negatively associated with procrastination and might be considered a resilience factor against unnecessary delay. The various facets of the trait as measured in popular personality traits include competence, efficient, order, organized, dutifulness, not careless, achievement striving, thorough, self-discipline, not lazy, and deliberation, not impulsive. Please rate yourself on a scale from 1 to 10 on this statement. I'm a very conscientious person, where 1 is not at all like me, and 10 is exactly like me. 2. Emotional instability. Emotional instability is the alternative wording of the trait of neuroticism. People who score high on emotional instability can be described as nervous, worrisome, or anxious. The various facets of the trait as measured in popular personality traits include anxiety, tense, angry, hostility, irritable, depression, not contented, self-consciousness, shy, impulsive, moody, and vulnerability, not self-confident. please rate yourself on the following statement. Typically, I would consider that I'm more neurotic or less emotionally stable than others. Rate yourself on a scale from 1, not at all like me, to 10, exactly like me. 3. Impulsiveness. A person who scores high on impulsiveness tends to act before thinking. This trait reflects low self-control, especially in the presence of potentially rewarding activities. Impulsivity reflects less ability to consider the consequences of one's actions. Please rate yourself on the following statement. Typically, I would say that I'm very impulsive. Rate yourself on a scale from 1, not at all like me, to 10, exactly like me. 4. Self-efficacy. This trait represents the belief that we're able to do what is necessary to achieve a desired outcome. It reflects self-confidence and competence. Please rate yourself on the following statement. I feel that I am competent and I have a great deal of self-efficacy. Rate yourself on a scale from 1, not at all like me, to 10, exactly like me. 5. Self-esteem. Self-esteem is how we feel about ourselves. It is our appraisal of our self-worth. Another way to think about it is the extent to which we perceive ourselves as being relatively close to being the people we want to be. Please rate yourself on the following statement. Generally, I feel very good about myself. Rate yourself on a scale from 1, not at all like me, to 10, exactly like me. 6. Socially prescribed perfectionism. As I noted, socially prescribed perfectionists believe that others hold unrealistic expectations for their behavior. They believe that others expect them to be perfect, and they can feel compelled to try to live up to these expectations. Please rate yourself on this statement. I believe that significant others in my life expect me to be perfect. Rate yourself on a scale from 1, not at all like me, to 10, exactly like me. Now that you have reviewed some of the main personality traits that researchers have identified as traits associated with procrastination, you can see which is larger, your risk for or resilience to procrastination. To calculate each, you need to sum some items together. For personality risk, sum items 2, 3, and 6, that is, emotional instability, impulsiveness, and perfectionism. For personality resilience, sum items 1, 4, and 5, that is, sum your ratings for conscientiousness, competence, and self-esteem. This simple scale is not scientifically valid, but it does provide you with a rough estimate of your vulnerability to procrastination from a personality perspective. These scores provide an index in terms of how your personality is contributing to or protecting you from self-regulation failure. Of course, given that you're listening to an audio program about procrastination, I might assume that you are more at risk than resilient. You may find that your risk score is quite a bit larger than your resilience score. The question is, what can you do about this? Strategy for change. Personality presents an interesting challenge when we think about self-change. By definition, we consider personality as the relatively enduring characteristics of the individual. They are not easily changed. However, we do not have to change our personalities to succeed. We can act counter to our dispositions or traits. For example, there are many introverted individuals who can function well socially, speak in front of crowds, and engage others effectively in the workplace. It does take strategic effort at times, but we are successful daily, acting out of character. It is important to acknowledge that some psychologists believe that acting out of character, counter to our traits and disposition, can deplete our self-regulatory strength or willpower. As we discussed previously, willpower is a limited resource, so this is important to recognize. We will be investing our energies to act out of character to succeed. everything noted earlier about bolstering our willpower will be important to take into account as you work to address your personality risk factors. In terms of procrastination, it is possible to act out of character in terms of low conscientiousness or high impulsivity. The key thing is to be strategic, and as we have discussed, part of being strategic is making pre-decisions about how to respond before you face a situation. If you can be proactive like this, you will not rely so much on your personality and habitual ways of responding. Remember the implementation intentions discussed earlier? These are intentions that take the form of, in situation X, I will do behavior Y. Implementation intentions, as you may recall, are a form of pre-decision. You are deciding ahead of time what will be a stimulus for what response. You may find implementation intentions useful again in terms of counteracting a habitual response that is part of who you are as defined by these personality traits. For example, if you are rather impulsive, your pre-decision with an implementation intention might be, if an alternative intention arises, such as an invitation to go out, I will say that I will make my decision in 10 minutes. This built-in pre-decisional delay may help to counteract the typical impulsive response to just get going. I think it is clear by now that the key issue is this pre-decision. Knowing a little bit about your personality traits that may put you at risk to procrastinate, you can now act on that knowledge by deciding in advance how you will counter this habitual response. For example, if you are impulsive, it is particularly important to reduce distractions in the surrounding environment when you are trying to work. Impulsive people have more difficulty resisting these distractions, even with implementation intentions. So, as I discussed in the previous chapter, part of your pre-decisional process can be to eliminate or reduce the distractions before you get down to work. Similarly, if you tend to be disorganized, deliberately working on structuring tasks can be very important to reducing procrastination. This can be as simple as creating a to-do list of subtasks that help you see the steps you need to take. It can also be the more challenging job of organizing your work area so that it is not so cluttered. But be careful. Some of us use this tidy-up job as our way to procrastinate. Once the desk is tidied, pencils sharpened, and new software downloaded onto the computer, we think, that's enough for today. Procrastination draws on our ability to deceive ourselves. We find excuses for just about any unnecessary delay. The strategies above address the issue of impulsivity and conscientiousness. What about the worry and anxiety that define low emotional stability? What if we are worried that we don't have the ability to do the task? What if we cannot tolerate frustration? This seems more serious, right? Yes, some of us are prone to worry and self-consciousness, and many of us have irrational beliefs that make us prone to procrastination. Our procrastination may be based on a fear of failure, for example. The route to self-change, both in the short-term behaviorally and the long-term in terms of stable personality change, is to challenge your worries and beliefs as they arise. When a task triggers thoughts such as, I can't do this, I'm such a screw-up, I don't know how, I'm going to fail, it's absolutely essential that you challenge each of these beliefs. Why do you think they are true? What is the real risk of not succeeding when you try? Through this process, most of us realize that these are truly irrational thoughts, perhaps part of the habits we call personality, but not real in terms of the world around us. In sum, I'm arguing that these stable individual differences we call personality traits can contribute to our procrastination. We cannot make changes in these traits quickly or easily, but we can recognize our relative self-regulatory strengths and limitations. In doing this, we set ourselves up to act more proactively and consciously out of character as we may need to achieve our goals. Perhaps most important to understand is that personality should not be an excuse. In fact, acknowledging and addressing our limitations can develop some of our greatest strengths. Chapter 10, Cyberslacking on the Procrastination Superhighway. It will only take a minute, puts me on a slippery slope toward procrastination. It's approaching midnight, and Ari still hasn't started to work on his report, even though he sat down at his computer at 7 p.m. When he got to his desk earlier that evening, his intention had been to get to work, but he thought, I'll just update my Facebook status. It will only take a minute. Now, hours later, he's still there. Issue. I've included this short chapter because internet-based technologies and other forms of technologically mediated communication, like smartphones, have created a whole new world of time wasting. There is little doubt that our best tools for productivity, computer technologies, are potentially also one of our greatest time wasters. In fact, the title of this chapter was taken from one of the published papers from our research group. In this paper, published more than a decade ago, long before social networking tools became popular, our participants reported that 47% of their time online was spent procrastinating. I think this is a conservative estimate. I doubt that I have to write very much to convince you that the internet has the potential to waste time if you want it to. People I know bemoan this fact all the time. The best example I have in relation to this chapter is a reply to one of my Psychology Today blog posts. In response to the "it will only take a minute" theme, an anonymous reader wrote, "I'm procrastinating. That's why I'm here. I just Google things I'm thinking about like this, or like I hear someone hum a familiar tune, so I look up the song to know who sang it. I mean, that literally takes a minute. But then that makes me Google a couple of other things, and then it ends up lasting a lot more than a few minutes. And I honestly don't realize when I end up reading the Wikipedia page of some random disease that some singer had that was related to the singer I was looking up. Wait, why was I looking him up? Oh, right, because someone at my school was humming a song by him. Oh, right, school. Essay due tomorrow. Haven't started. Like right now. I just realized I'm commenting on an article. I wish I could read those articles about my essay and try to get 2,000 words on a paper in a day. The thing is, we can end up wasting time even when we do not want to. This is the real problem, and the one that we need to identify in order to make change. I just want to be clear about something. I'm not saying we cannot work and play online. Personally, I really enjoy these technologies. I use them intensively, in fact. And I know we will see them grow in importance. What I'm emphasizing is that we can waste time in unexpected and unanticipated ways with these technologies when we don't want to. This is the issue. These technologies are particularly problematic when it comes to self-regulation and self-regulation failure. In the scenario above, Ari did plan to work on his report. He got to his desk as planned. What happened? Ari made a rational decision over an irrationally short period of time. Although it is correct that it might take only a minute to update my Facebook page, a minute later, Ari faced the same decision. Of course, as we learned in Chapter 5, our thinking can let us down here. We can rationalize yet another minute of delay, as another minute will certainly not compromise the report writing. It's an intransitive preference at its best, isn't it? At midnight, Ari recognizes that it's preferable to act much sooner than he has, even though each minute prior to that, he preferred to delay just a little more. This issue of rational decisions over irrationally short periods of time, combined with problems in our thinking, like intransitive preferences, is not the only reason that the internet, and social networking in particular, are potentially so hazardous to our goal pursuit. There are other reasons that we are prone to procrastinate online. One of the reasons that social networking is so rewarding is that it fulfills a basic human need, at least at some level. That is the need for relatedness. We are social animals, and social networking makes sense. 2. Online social networking is also immediately rewarding. This is a potentially addictive combination, rewarding and immediate. In fact, there is a great deal written about internet addictions. Although it is beyond the scope of my writing to delve into this topic, it is important to note that the powerfully addictive nature of the internet contributes to the self-regulation failure that you now understand is at the heart of procrastination. It can undermine our best intentions. 3. A third reason that the internet can be a problem for procrastination is that it's a ready distraction, which is particularly troublesome for those of us who are impulsive. In fact, it can be a problem for all of us because of so many push technologies. For example, email and text messages are pushed to us throughout the day. So as we work, we can be constantly interrupted if we leave our email client and phone active in the background. These distractions can be exceptionally disruptive at moments when our on-task work is not going well. Then we are back to that, it will only take a minute to, and our goal pursuit ends in favor of tasks that we are really not choosing to do, at least not in the long run, although it can end up that way to our detriment. 4. On top of all of this is the myth of multitasking. I say myth because despite popular beliefs, research indicates that only a very small percentage of people can actually multitask effectively. Humans have a very limited attentional channel. We are better off focused on one thing at a time. Tragic traffic accidents are only one example of how potentially dangerous the myth of multitasking can be as texting drivers lose their focus on the road. The more mundane tragedy of multitasking is how we deceive ourselves into thinking that we are actually doing our work, when in fact we are attending sporadically to our tasks in between email, social networking updates, internet searches, e-commerce, and gaming. Strategies for change. Although I discussed the procrastination superhighway as a separate chapter in this book, the principles for change are not really that different. They may just be a whole lot less appealing. For example, we have already addressed the notion of minimizing distractions when we discussed impulsivity. Minimizing distractions is part of that pre-decision to keep us on task. Minimizing distractions is an important part of curbing our online procrastination. To stay really connected to our goal pursuit, we need to disconnect from potential distractions like social networking tools. This means that we should not have Facebook, Twitter, email, or whatever your favorite suite of tools is running in the background on your computer or smartphone while you are working. Shut them off. Ouch, I know. It's really tempting to find some excuse to keep it a business-as-usual approach here, but if you are committed to reducing your procrastination, this is something you really need to do. You must shut off everything except the program you need on your computer to do the task at hand. This means you can plan your e-breaks more consciously. Again, this is an example of pre-decisions that help us break unconscious habits. Procrastination is certainly a habit for many of us. This strategy of reducing distractions makes it more obvious when you are turning away from your goal pursuit to pursue some other task. Your alternative and potentially rewarding alternative tasks are no longer only a click away. A little more effort provides time for you to think if this is really what you want to do. Do you really want to abandon your goal right now? Probably not. There have been all sorts of tools and apps designed to help people regulate their internet use more. Common current examples include tools that lock you out of your email or record what applications you are using and for how long. These may be helpful to you, but techniques and technologies can never be a substitute for a commitment to change. I think it's appropriate to end this final chapter where I began our consideration of why we procrastinate. Giving in to feel good. Giving in to feel good is a big piece of the procrastination puzzle, and the internet provides lots and lots of short-term but specious rewards to which we can give in to feel good. With a click or two, we can leave the task that we feel bad about and seek immediate mood repair. If you understand that this is what you are doing, you are truly on the road to change. That does not mean that this is easy. And I turn now to some thoughts about the road ahead. It is a journey that is often described as 2 steps forward, 1 step back. Concluding thoughts. On the Road of Self-Change. Self-change is a journey I take daily, and I will persevere patiently as I take two steps forward and one step back. Mariana is discouraged. Yesterday went so well. She started her work exactly when she intended to, and she stayed on task. It felt great. She made significant progress on her thesis. Today she feels like her old self. She doesn't want to do anything. She's already wasted the morning filing email, most of which she knows she'll never look at again, and texting friends. Feeling low on energy, she's thinking of having a nap after lunch. Deep down, she knows she's just avoiding her work again. Issue. Even though the purpose of the digest format of this audio program is to make it a quick listen, there are no quick fixes. Our old bad habits, like procrastination, are hard to change, and new habits are difficult to establish. We have to put in a great deal of conscious effort before our new behaviors become routine, non-conscious patterns in our lives. Sometimes we never completely establish a new habit, and we have to put in conscious effort daily to maintain our focus where we choose. The key thing is to be strategic. By being strategic, by making pre-decisions as much as possible, we can keep from following the same old worn path, the path that we know best as procrastination. As you have learned, there are many aspects of being human that contribute to our self-regulation failure. For example, we like to feel good now, are prone to discount future rewards, are overly optimistic and biased in our planning, dislike dissonance and will resolve it by making excuses, have a limited amount of willpower, can be disorganized, undisciplined, and overly self-conscious, can be prone to distractions, and can have irrational beliefs about our expectations of ourselves. Each of these things can create problems for us in our goal pursuit and contribute to our procrastination. Even this partial list of factors contributing to procrastination reveals some important truths worth remembering when you feel like Mariana does in the scenario above. First, each of us will have a different constellation of factors that is our recipe for procrastination. As you listen to this audio program, I am sure that some topics and issues spoke more directly to you than others. These are the issues that you need to address in your efforts for self-change. These are the issues you can address beginning right now. Second, we cannot change everything at once. My emphasis has been on being strategic. You need to be strategic in your approach to self-change as well. Pick one or two issues that you recognize are problems for you. Listen to the chapter on these issues again if necessary, and focus on those strategies first. You can build from there. Third, this self-change process is uneven. We truly do feel like one day we leap ahead and the next day we fall back. Although we have to be committed to change and firm in our efforts to be strategic, we also have to be kind to ourselves during this challenging process. We all face setbacks, disappointing moments, and frustrations with our apparent lack of progress. Your attitude towards these setbacks and yourself will be extremely important to your continued progress. Be kind but firm with yourself, and be willing to forgive yourself when you do not live up to your own expectations. One of our recent studies was about this issue of self-forgiveness and procrastination. It has important implications for each of us as we take the self-change journey. What we found was that self-forgiveness for procrastination was related to less procrastination in the future. Specifically, when students in our study had procrastinated quite a bit on their preparation for an exam, if they self-forgave for this procrastination, they were less likely to procrastinate on their preparation for the subsequent exam. This finding reflects the power of forgiveness to move us from an avoidance motivation to an approach motivation. If, for example, you had a transgression, example a fight or a broken promise, with a friend, and you or your friend had not offered forgiveness, you would likely avoid that friend. In the case of procrastination, The transgression is against the self, and we end up avoiding the task associated with that transgression. What forgiveness does in both cases is to remove the avoidance motivation so that friendship can be reestablished or engagement with the task can happen again, respectively. On our self-change journey, we have to be prepared to forgive ourselves for our transgressions so that we are willing to try again. We will certainly have to try again many times. As I said before, even my simple strategy of just get started may have to be invoked many times throughout the day. Start and restart. Success will be found in this effort. It is worth the effort, as was your time in considering why it is that we procrastinate. I hope listening to this audio program is your first step in this journey of self-change. I would love to hear about your own journey. What worked? What didn't? What else would you like to know? Although I cannot promise to answer every email, your input will make a difference to future writing. I invite you to write to me at comments@procrastination.ca. Finally, you may want to learn more about procrastination. This digest format audio program, while accurate and firmly based on research in the area, is by necessity short on details. If you want to learn more, you can find lots more through our research group website, procrastination.ca. This website provides access to many relevant resources, not just our own scholarly publications. Perhaps some of the most accessible information is available through my Don't Delay blog for Psychology Today and through my I Procrastinate podcasts. The blog entries and podcast episodes summarize a wide variety of information about procrastination in much greater detail. In fact, you can search through the blog entries or the podcast titles on iTunes to find information specific to the issues with which you may be struggling. I must say that I make this reference to further reading with some reservation. There is no end to the reading about a topic, and the problem with procrastination, as you have learned, is that we can always find an excuse not to do our work. In this case, it is really quite possible to use your further reading and research about procrastination to procrastinate more. Ironically, this is something that readers of my blog and listeners of my podcast have told me that they do. So instead of reading more, I would have you return to where I began the book to remind you that reducing procrastination in our lives is a practical thing. Sensible, realistic, no nonsense. In addition, I want to add that change is about doing, not just reading. If you put these both together, you will see that the practical and no nonsense thing is to start doing, not to read more. You probably took an interest in this audio program because you want to reduce procrastination in your life. You now know a great deal more about the topic. You are prepared to bolster what feels like a depleted willpower. You are aware that it is tempting to give in to feel good, so you won't right now. And you know that every journey begins with that important first step. It is time to just get started. I know that this will make a difference in your life.
This has been a Gildan Audio production. For more affordable life-changing audio programs, visit our website at gildanmedia.com.